Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 81. One Voice from Two Worlds. Native Peoples Stories, Part 2. Once again, reading selections from a fascinating anthology, Genocide of the Mind, New Native American Writing, edited by Mary Jo Moore, with a foreword by Vine Deloria Jr. Poetry mixed in with the essays, and along with hearing from Native people's voices how they deal with living pretty much in two worlds nowadays and how they maintain some of their ancient traditions. Also many pointers and insights into how to live a better life and how to have a spirituality amidst the worldliness we all deal with. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Continuing with the section on native languages, this bits are by Joseph Dan Durand. He is Kwantlen, K-W-A-N-T-L-E-N, from the Kwantlen First Nation in British Columbia. Poet, playwright, fisherman, researcher, archaeologist, and most important, a proud father of a beautiful girl. His produced plays include Crackers and Soup, No Totem for My Story, Where Two Rivers Meet, and Please Don't Touch the Indians, for the Red Path Theater in Chicago. And his poems have appeared in numerous journals and anthologies. And his other name is X period A-L-A-T-S-E-P, which means written down. And he writes, I was so proud the first time I heard my Indian name called out to witness the work that was to be done. I stood tall and completely at ease as the family doing the work walked over to me, and each member placed two quarters in my hand and thanked me for witnessing the work they were doing that night in a longhouse far into the woods of British Columbia. That is how it is done, this ritual, old and repeated like tradition over and over and over again. Other rituals repeated the same, not talked about. That is true spirituality, true and untouched by history that has been kept hidden and still stays hidden. Only those who live the life and the old ways know the truth. My name means written down and was given to me by our people, the Kwantlen, a small group of river people, fishermen, on the Fraser River, There were 12 of us who were given names. Mine came from my grandfather's side, from the Nooksack tribe just down below us across the border in Washington State. It was then written in our language and translated by a group of elders upriver from our village. No one here at the time spoke our language. We, the Kwantlen, used to number in the thousands. Now we are 150 and counting. Our elders are young, and most do not know their language, nor do they know their traditions. It is sad, but it is a reality of what happened here and continues to happen. The greatest destruction to us, residential, schools, alcohol, welfare, fishing laws, development, were passed off as attempts to assimilate us. But we struggle onward. In my village, we try to do the best we can, but we are limited by the connection we have with a greater society, which ate us up and continues to eat us up. It just does it in a quieter way, the quiet revolution of the not-talked-about assimilation of natives. And later on in his piece, he writes, "So, with my name that I carry so proudly and the spirit that I now have, I walk onward, trying my best to soothe the worries of the less fortunate. I help those who cannot help themselves. I try my best to protect my family from harm from the outside world and the world that we live in. I try to walk the good life. I am gentle to those who do not understand. I do my best to teach those who wish to listen. That is greatest lesson of all, one that I learned on my journey to where I am now. The greatest lesson we can all learn is to listen, to open your ears and listen and learn. If you never listen, how can you move forward? Listen and learn and take care of yourself and your spirit." And the next bit from Carol Snow Moon Bakofner. "Missisquoi Abenaki is originally from Maine and a poet and freelancer. Her poems have appeared in dozens of journals and anthologies in the U.S. and Canada. Just books from a while ago, so she was a graduate student working on an MFA in writing at Vermont College. A major focus for Carol is to help ensure that Indian writers and storytellers have an equal voice in the literary and academic worlds." And there was just a few lines I underlined out of her piece that most impressed me. "By age 40, I was fully involved in the Abenaki culture to the extent one can be at a 3,000-mile distance from home country. I was living in California and part of an intertribal circle. As part of the circle, I fasted twice a year for 4 days and took part in traditional pipe ceremonies and sweats. At a fast on tribal lands near Palm Springs, I heard someone speaking distinctly like Nana B. An Ojibwe priest was speaking Ojibwe. It sounded so much like Nana's language. I was happy to hear the rolling, throaty sounds. I wanted more. I told him what Nana had said and asked him how I could find a way to learn Abenaki. He gave me the best possible advice. Start with the word for the Creator, and He will slowly give you the rest." And in this short bit from James Aroniotis, however it's pronounced, "Stevens, we will not lose our words." And he's a member of the Akwesasne Mohawk tribe in upstate New York. He attended the Institute of American Indian Arts, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa, and Brown University. He's the author of Tokenish and Combing the Snakes from His Hair, and a 2000 Whiting Writers Award winner, and at the time of this, assistant professor of English and American Indian Studies at the State University of New York at Fredonia. And there's one paragraph in his that I highlighted. "How is a canoe song relevant to my life? Every day I move against a stream of other lives, currents of emotion, eddies of fear or pain. Each day my arms reach for another, birch ribs under skin, trying to find a flow of unity. This is how a canoe song helps me. This is what I am trying to show in my work, specifically in the work that relies on Mohawk language for imagery and meaning." Yeah, it's a beautiful lesson from that. You know, sometimes people feel like, you know, things are outdated or antiquated, or, you know, those times are done, but it's, you know, the songs and the language still convey the spirit of the times and the essence of whatever the actions, you know, whether it's the hunting or the fishing or just this, you know, the going down the stream in a canoe, whatever it is that in the previous show talked about. It was Ortiz talking about his father and connecting with his dear friend, and through the song it comes alive again in the appreciation. So, you know, a deep connection that we can maintain with the past, is present, and future. And a piece called The Spirit of Language by Neil McKay. McKay is from the Sacred Lake Dweller Nation of Dakota and an enrollee in the Spirit Lake Reservation in North Dakota. He is the first in his family to attend college and graduated with a degree in American Indian Studies with a focus on the Dakota language from the University of Minnesota at Minneapolis in 1997, where at the time he was the Dakota language instructor. Neil's lifelong goal is to ensure that the Dakota language continues to live on within the people. His piece talks about children and how a child knows language, at least this section here. When I said, there's a Dakota word there, I won't try to pronounce it, my wife asked what that meant, and I thought about how to explain it. Before I could say anything, Ian said, that's his child, it's where you go to make friends or be friends with another. I wondered how this little 3-year-old could respond so quickly and precisely upon hearing the word for the first time. It soon occurred to me that he was thinking in Dakota. I later learned about the process of internalizing the language. It is said that children by the age of 3 are already fluent in their language or languages. From birth or while in the womb, children imprint the mechanics of the language itself, the grammar, vocabulary, voice, inflection, etc., and prepare it for future use in communicating. They have the native thought process and intuition within them. I have heard many times that the only way to bring back the Dakota language is to raise a generation of fluent speakers. An Ojibwe elder said when the people could no longer speak Ojibwe, they become only descendants of the Ojibwe. I believe this is true of any language. If we raise our children speaking Dakota, they will be able to think as our ancestors did. This is why we need to teach our children while they are still infants. So it's not just, you know, it's not just the spoken language, the thinking process, emotive process behind it, of course, that is, you know, important. And, you know, he accentuates the meeting with elders. Many of our elders remind us they won't be around forever, so we need to move now to learn from them. Talks about visiting an elder. She told me that as an elder, she is still learning. She said that when someone comes to learn from her, she also learns from them, and that is why we need to visit with our elders. It's necessary to be around as many speakers as possible because each speaker has her or his own way of conveying thoughts in the language. In the days before European contact, if someone spoke differently, it identified the speaker's community. This is still true today. An elder recently told me that differences in language are acceptable. We tease one another about the differences within our language. This form of teasing is also a good teaching tool because when the differences are discussed, there is always a good lesson to learn. And a section by Sean Lee Farlander, born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, raised on the White Earth and Leech Lake reservations in northern Minnesota. Joined the United States Navy during his freshman year in college and served throughout the Gulf War. He returned home and finished school at Leech Lake Tribal College, where he graduated with honors. He has worked as a cultural coordinator for Northwestern Minnesota Juvenile Center, public relations coordinator for Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and has held many civic positions throughout the state. And his piece is called Names by Which the Spirit Knows Us. And he writes, the day he named me will never be far from my mind. I had asked him to do this because of the esteem I had for him. This is the surrogate father teacher talking about. In the old days, it would have been left up to my parents to choose someone to be my namesake. A lot has changed since then. However, my generation is one of the first to start the long walk back to our traditions. I passed tobacco to the old man and asked him to be my namesake. He used my tobacco to ask the spirits to reveal to him what it was they called me. After receiving the insight, he shared it with me in front of several people from the community and my family. He then smoked his pipe and we feasted my new name. It was the start of a great journey, and thankfully it has not ended. One of the important things I've learned on this trail is how names come to be. Part of my understanding is, as we pass through life, most of the time we are blissfully unaware of the spirits that exist along with us. I'm certain that we grow away from the ability to interact with them. In a way, I think we have lost the awe that allowed us to see. Even if we don't let ourselves be aware of the spirits, I'm sure they are aware of us. I like to think of this like gravity. We live our whole lives never seeing gravity, just its effects. We trip and fall, we drop things, and at times even defy gravity for our own purposes. But in the end, gravity is what keeps us grounded. I believe that the spirits act in the same manner. Most of the time we ignore them, we even defy the spirits for our own purposes, but still they keep us spiritually grounded, and when the spirits talk about us, they call us by the names they have for us. That is why my people use the term indigo, which literally translates, "the spirits call me." So again, a wonderful reminder of, it's how, I think it's that T.S. Eliot, the end is the beginning, or to wind up, you wind up where you started and recognize it for the first time. And I think when people start having spiritual experiences, part of the sort of joke is that, the spirit beings have been there all along. It's like they're in the next room and the door is closed, and it's not like they're not there, but so it goes. And continuing, some 12 years ago, I went on my first fast. I was sitting on the ground way back in the bush. On the second morning, something happened that clarified my place in the creation. Just as the sun was breaking over Strawberry Mountain, I discovered myself. It was early fall, and the frost hadn't yet driven away the insects. I was wearing black jeans, and as I watched the morning start, I looked down. Crawling on the grass next to me were hundreds of bumblebees drinking the dew. As I watched, some of the bees left the grass and started to crawl on my legs. Soon I had over 50 bees drinking the dew off my pants. At first I was scared to move, but as I continued to watch, I didn't want to move. My fear had been replaced by awe. As the day warmed and the bees flew away on their business, I sat in wonder, what does this mean? For the rest of the morning, this question ran through my head repeatedly. Around noon, it hit me. To those bees, I was just another piece of grass. I existed on the same level as any other part of the world, not above or below, but with. I was another part of creation and not the creation itself. I don't want to give the wrong impression because that would only cheapen the event. Many other things happened during my fast that I choose not to talk about and keep to myself. They have become my touchstones and remind me of the balance that exists in creation, and I find myself returning to them often just to reflect. These happenings still teach me. Now, in the Western culture, we kind of have, college is kind of the rite of passage, and in a way, we are lacking that vision quest that the natives have in their traditions of finding a direction in one's life early on. And I remember Teokasin commenting about, seeing a lot of Western culture as sort of a teenage mentality. And it's like without a certain sense of a ritual or a certain rites of passage, a lot of people don't mature and they don't go through a certain gate of learning. And so, a lot of behavior continues on unless it's dealt with. And then another wise section here. An old man from Red Lake once told me the difference between knowledge, experience, and wisdom. He said knowledge can be sought, experience is had, but wisdom comes only by combining the first two with reflective thought and then applying it to your life. I've watched people who, in their rush to become, get lost. It's like they're trying to complete a resume of Indianness. Find my name, find my clan, learn my language and everything I can about my culture, and then I'll be Indian enough. I've seen people spend so much time becoming instead of belonging that they never allow themselves just to be. And another interesting story here that he tells, I'll continue on from what he just said. I was taught that by the right of being born, we belong. We belong to our family, we belong to our clan, and we belong to our people. All the shit in the world can't change that. I also think that becoming is not a static event. It's linear and fluid, like time. Everything we see, smell, touch, or otherwise sense adds to our experiences and changes our perspectives and us. We can exercise very little control over an event, and in many ways it just happens, but we do have control over being. We have to choose to be. We can allow ourselves just to be who we are and live in the moment. For me, this is almost impossible to do. I have to make that conscious choice to let things happen. I find myself having to shut out the electronic noise that has become so much of my life. This is much harder than it sounds. I've gone to great lengths to divorce myself from silence. The cell phone, internet, TV, all this white noise drowns out the quiet whispers of the creation trying to remind me that I belong. I've been on the other side, too. I used to spend all my free time at or in ceremony and was losing touch with myself. I had gotten to the point that ceremony had taken me over. I was like an alcoholic who sobers up and finds that he is incapable of living life without AA, and then AA becomes his fix. Me, I became a ceremony junkie. This went on for over a year before my elder pulled me to the side and told me that life was not a ceremony. He said, when ceremony is over, go out and live life for a while. I had spent so much time inside the bubble of ceremony that I quit doing the things I enjoyed. It took time for me to feel comfortable doing the hunting, fishing, and hiking I love because I thought that I was cheating on ceremony. What does this have to do with naming? Well, in a word, balance. Any kind of extreme is unhealthy, and to place more importance on any one facet of our lives forces us to ignore the rest. For my people, a name is a key that opens doors, but we must walk through them. Once through the doorway, we find that the road has many forks, and we must choose which way to go. A name can't do that for you. You must do it for yourself. The name is not the journey, just the beginning of it. The next section gets into mascots, and that is a powerful section. I was not expecting the kind of emotional charge in that section, so I'm going to hold off on getting into that yet, but go back here and read one of Joseph Dandaran, aka Written Down, read one of his poems. This is Fort Langley. You can see the fort from where I live. Wooden walls, trees, desperate voices, they call to me, come on over, come on over, come on. Shut up, and stay over there, I say. Used to drink at their bar, used to sip whiskey, used to fight, used to be blind from it all. Now I stare at their walls, wooden walls, thick with history. Many men and women never made it home. They found them trying to climb over the walls. Whiskey bottles broken and empty roll down to the river. Laceless shoes sit silent as if waiting to fit someone else. A picture of someone's mother blows away and over the walls. The gate is closed. The fort. Over that way, over past the mass grave. Smallpox. You ever seen smallpox? Pretty ugly. Not as pretty as wooden walls. And one more from him. Before me. Read a book about the past. It seemed real enough for me to go there, so I went. 1900 something or other. Old time. Back then. Before me. Before. River looked the same. Treacherous. Silent, unforgiving, more trees than now, more eagles, deer, salmon, humans with faces. Saw them. They wore the paint. Not like now, not like humans now. I tried to talk to them, but the river came and got me. It took me down. Shit, I think my shoes fell off. My toes touched the bottom. I woke up as the ones with paint came to me and told me never, never tell. Tell what? No answer. Tell what? Only water. I found my shoes. They were next to my bed, right where I left them. The past. Before. Before me. So clouded, so uneven. Future. After. After me. Eternity, I think. Eternal water. The paint. Faces. Humans with paint on their faces. Brothers and sisters. Crying the song, drumming the past. Never. Never read a book about your past. It becomes you. You become it. My face, it has the paint. My voice, it has my song. My eyes, they have never, ever let go. So whenever part three happens, that'll be about the mascots section in the book called Indians as Mascots, an issue to be resolved. That's been a kind of hot topic nowadays, what with the Washington Redskins and other sports teams, and you know, it's a significant thing to talk about. So we'll do some of that and read some more next time. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.
And we'll go out with two pieces. Found these on YouTube. One is by Navajo singer Taliba Begay, and Navajo also, they call themselves Diné. D-I-N-E with an accent. And interesting about this bit is that She speaks a little, explaining the song, and then you get to hear some of the song is in with the Navajo language. And then the second piece is beautiful Ojibwe prayer song, and they're about 7 minutes total.
Hello, my name is Taliba Begay. My Navajo name is Desba. My maternal clan is the Red Bottom people. My paternal clan is the Mexican people clan. My maternal grandparents are the Red Running Into the Water people. And my paternal grandparents are the Sleep by the Rock people. I am from Sherbrooke, New Mexico, but my family comes from Big Ishtol, located in Sonoste, New Mexico. And I am 16 years old, and that's how I represent myself in today's society. Di siniki ishlagi, di awe pa, di nasto ne jono gonani tato sinikita. The song is the translation in the song is niche bitigin pahalyago. May the spirits watch over my child, like the spirit in the child. Pahalyago, that's what that means. And also the a Mother Earth may my child walk in beauty. And then Tradity Bekek Ego Atinigo Nijonago Shawet Nahula. That means with corn pollen, with my child praying with corn pollen every morning, my child will walk in beauty. And this song is a walk in beauty song. It's relating to a baby as they grow up in maturity, and it's just telling the baby that you'll grow up in a good way and everything. And she'awet nijonago she'awet nahula just means may my child walk in beauty. Ehwete nijo nijo Nehijo ne go o shewe na hua a la la la. Nehijo o. Nehijo o. Nehijo ne go o shewe na hua a la la la. Piti e en bahalia ako shewe. Nahua, ah, nejo, 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 Nehijo ne go o she o we na hu la 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 ho ho jo go o she o we na hu la la la.